Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to another Peak Prosperity podcast. I am your host, of course, Chris Martinson, and today we have the pleasure of speaking with Matt Stein. Matt is an MIT-trained mechanical engineer who specializes in the design and construction of energy-efficient and environmentally friendly homes. He's also the author of a best-selling book that has a place of honor on my bookshelf, When Technology Fails, a manual for self-reliance, sustainability, and surviving the long emergency. Now, it's one of the most practical and useful field guides for what to do when our centralized systems suddenly aren't available to us. Maybe because of a storm-induced power outage, or someday possibly due to an oil shortage. The list is endless at this day and age. The knowledge contained within his book and several other of Matt's excellent publications are relevant to anyone looking to live with resilience, whatever the future may bring. And that includes his newest book, just out in November 2011, entitled When Disaster Strikes. Yes, his writings seek to help people navigate difficult times, and Matt's a very hopeful person with a cheerful outlook, as describes many people listening to this podcast, including myself. Matt, I'm thrilled to have you here. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Chris. It's a real pleasure to be on your show today.
Great. Well, let's start at the very outside. I like to start there. Trained as an engineer, you looked at our highly complex, just-in-time economic and technical methods and practices and decided to write a book about the ways in which technology might fail us. At heart, you've trained a cautionary eye towards modern technology when, I might say, most people's faith in the same is hitting new highs with every release of the next generation smartphone. What risks do you see in all this technological complexity that a casual consumer might be missing?
Well, a while back, I wrote an article called The Perfect Storm, Six Trends Converging on Collapse. And, you know, you and I and most of us grew up in high school and we drew graphs in algebra class or geometry or whatever. Mm-hmm. And if a graph is headed steeply for the bottom, then we know unless you do something significantly different, it's going to hit the bottom. And the problem with our complex world right now is that we have six major trends and many more, you know, complex subtrends.
Yep.
That are all headed for the bottom. And we haven't successfully changed course on any one of these six trends. So logic says if we keep this up, if we keep doing business as usual, just what we've been doing all along, that these trends will hit the wall and it will collapse the world as we know it and society will fall apart. Now, on top of that, we live in an extremely complex world where nowadays there's only an average of 3 days of food in any city in the Western world at a particular moment in time. Used to be there would be a warehouse with a month's worth of food or multiple warehouses around each city. But now, with computers and the internet and just-in-time deliveries, basically what you're going to eat next week is on the truck being shipped from somewhere across the country this week. So it doesn't take a real genius to realize that something complex like that that's operating on just-in-time, all it takes is one little glitch and all of a sudden things are backed up for a long time, nothing's getting there, and, you know, we're in trouble. And a huge glitch that's certainly a big possibility in terms of, you know, major game-changing events is if we had an electromagnetic event, such as an extreme solar storm, which we've had twice in the last 160 years. It's just that the last one was in 90 years ago in 1921, and if that one happened today, it would shut down the grid over most of the world, and most of the world's nuclear power plants would start burning up. So we have multiple individual events that could instantly grind civilization to a halt, and then we have these long-term trends, which actually are not very long-term. They're relatively short-term, like, you know, collapsing sometime within the next few decades. If we don't do something major, are going to shut down the world as we know it.
Now, these six big trends, what are these?
Okay. Just real briefly, and then we can talk about each individually if you wish. The first one is climate change, or I like to call it global weirding, some call it global warming, but we're seeing the evidence of a much less stable climate on our planet, and we're seeing the evidence that if the trends that scientists predict are correct, the world's main breadbaskets will not be producing much food within the next few decades as they start to fry and cook in a changing world. So that's number one. Number two is a peak in world oil production. And as our world goes around today, oil is the number one energy producing, you know, energy dense material. It's easy to pump and move around to do our cars. And we've basically got the easy to get, you know, cheap, clean, relatively clean oil. And now we're doing things like drilling for oil 5 miles underneath the Gulf and in the far North Arctic. And we're fracking and horizontal drilling and doing all kinds of hoops just to keep the world's oil supply running as basically keep production flat. Now, for the last 100 years, we've been increasing oil production about 10% a year, and that's fueled an amazing growth in the industries of the world. And right now, we're struggling just to keep it flat. And I don't think we're ever going to do much better than that. And as things start to decline really badly, it will cost a huge amount to get the remaining oil out, and so we'll either produce less because it costs so much, or we'll spend so much money, and we've already seen what that's been doing to the economy.
All right.
Number three is collapse of the world's oceans, and it turns out that 11 of 15 of the world's major ocean fisheries are either already collapsed or in danger of short-term collapse.
Yep.
And we have acidification, you know, when we burn our fossil fuels and it rains, it makes carbonic acid, it goes into the rivers, well, that goes in the oceans. So we're also collapsing coral reefs, which are like the rainforests of the oceans and the part of the lungs of the planet that keep our atmosphere livable. And we're killing the plankton. We have, since 1950, according to a British scientific study, we've lost 73% of the world's zooplankton. That's the bottom of the food chain. And most of that, over half of that, has happened in the last 20 years. So we're doing things that are changing the oceans and killing the oceans in a very rapid period of time. I mean, they were pretty healthy 30, 40 years ago, and they're not any longer. And then the forests of the world, about half of them are gone now, and a good chunk of the other half is seriously degraded. The food crisis is a big one, and that's a combination of unsustainable use of water, climate change, and unsustainable farming practices where we're flushing our topsoil that took millions of years to generate. We're just flushing it down the tube, and it's ending up, you know, in behind dams and in the ocean and not on the fields any longer. And number six is the big kind of driver behind it all, and that's the world's population. And to give you an idea of how much population has changed, from the time Jesus walked the earth until Abraham Lincoln walked the earth, fewer people were added to our planet from Jesus to Abraham Lincoln than in the last 10 years. So think of that. Every 10 years, we're adding more people to our world than were added in the 1800 years between Jesus and Abraham Lincoln. And since we added 1 billion people between the beginning of 2000 and October of 2011, we added 1 billion people. That's equal to the entire world population just in the year 1800. So just under 12 years, we added more people than were alive in the entire world 110 years ago, 120 years ago. So that's something that it just cannot be sustained. And we're seeing that. We're collapsing the natural systems of the world. And so if we don't do things significantly different, nature is not a little kind, benevolent thing that says, oh, you human beings, I'll take pity on you and I'll magically, you know, turn the valve on and change things for you. It's like, no. When you overshoot nature's natural boundaries, then the result is collapse. And we see that over and over again throughout nature, where populations boom and then bust. And if human beings don't do something different, we're going to be in that same boat.
Well, nature does bat last. As my science background is biologically based, so I'm very familiar with these concepts as they apply to all organisms. I do consider humans a type of organism, so I don't know that we're In fact, I do know this. I'll be more clear about this. We are subject to the same rules and regulations that nature sets forth as any other organism. And there, you went down this list, you know, global weirding, and we've got peak oil, obviously, and I would add to that potentially other resource extractions, which are unsustainable by their very nature because these are non-renewable resources.
That's correct. There's all kinds of rare earth metals that are critical to manufacturing the products we use in electronics and solar panels and things like that. And those also have limits to their growth, and we've run through a lot of the best deposits of these things, and
Absolutely.
Now we're scrambling to keep things going. So yes, we're running into limits in many directions, and oil is just kind of one of the most obvious ones.
Yes, and then you went with ocean collapse and acidification. We've obviously got forest loss. We've got a food crisis related to water, big trend in water use there. A lot of news coming out about how aquifers are being depleted. And, of course, population driving all of this. And around this, there's this wrapper of this thing we call the economy. This is how we organize ourselves. And it's been fashioned as if none of these trends were real. It's been fashioned as if we can just continue to expand forever. And this is where we get to the heart of this story, which is we can all hope that these things you've just cataloged and other ones that we could raise are not going to bite us at some point. But in this story, I think hope alone, terrible strategy.
Yeah, it's a real strategy for failure. I mean, wishful thinking, it may be great. You know, you watch the movie The Secret, and you know, if you just think good thoughts, then you're going to manifest tons of money and everything's going to be okay. But the reality is, you know, we live in a bubble around the planet Earth. We do live in a bubble, and we don't have a way of getting out of our bubble, and so we have to live within the means that are contained within this bubble. There was an experiment, a biodome down in Arizona, where they spent $200 million, and they built a big geodesic dome, and they put systems in there the best scientists, you know, worked on it to make it self-sustainable. And they had six scientists in there, and they were supposed to stay in there for 3 years. Well, they had to cut the experiment short. So with $200 million on the planet Earth, this isn't out in space, this isn't on the moon, this isn't on Mars, this is on the planet Earth, just in Arizona, $200 million, they could not make a bubble that kept itself going for only six people with $200 million. Now, I don't have $200 million in my pocket to make my bubble.
Well, and it was, of course, the very best of minds, and they did think it through, and they ran an experiment. And like all good experiments, there were some things that they learned. That's why they're experiments. We don't know all the variables. I believe one of the things that bit them was that the concrete they used to pour much of the footings absorbed CO2 at a much faster rate than they'd known about. And so the point of all this is that technology brings extraordinary advantages, and there are these disadvantages that we don't always think about that just come along for the ride. Yes, we're getting oil out of shale. It's just amazing. You know, we're taking it from the source rocks, and we do this fracking, and we get 1,000 barrels per day to flow out of a well, but it depletes at extraordinary rates. And within a few years, it's a stripper well, you know, getting less than 20 barrels per day out. And all the technology has really done, it's allowed us to get a little more out of the ground in the case of this oil story, but what it also does is allows us to get it out faster. So yes, we get more out, but we also get it out faster, so it runs out sooner. You know, two sides on this coin.
Margaret Thatcher, she, you know, there's a good examples of that is in the North Sea oil, where Norway and Britain sort of had two different approaches. So Norway kind of did the slow, long-run approach for developing it. I mean, it's still going to run out. And Margaret Thatcher was like, boom. So they just pumped and pumped and pumped, and it made for a great boom in the economy in England, and they were selling oil at $10 a barrel. Well, now they're importing oil. They've gone from an exporter of oil for 30 years or 25 years off North Shore oil, North Sea oil, and now that oil is toast. So it's declining rapidly, and they have to import. Whereas Norway, you know, is now selling their oil at $100, $140 a barrel, and they've still got oil around for another, you know, two or three decades, not like 200 years. And so which was smarter? Was it smarter to go a little slow and steady, or smarter to go boom and bust? Any way you look at it, it's running out. If you're slow and steady, at least you give yourself more time to develop the alternatives to get off the oil habit while there's still some around to keep things rolling.
Well, I have to say that my personal view, and this is a belief of mine, is that watching the current election cycle here in late 2012 before the November elections. I don't see any distinguishable daylight between the two parties. It's just they have different views on how we're going to get ourselves back on the fastest possible path of growth as soon as possible. So business as usual. And you just mentioned that there are a lot of things that could disrupt our just-in-time delivery system, food, fuel, medicine, maybe water, virtually everything that we consider life's essentials. You know, perhaps it will be a catastrophic banking failure that takes months to patch up, a solar flare you mentioned, like a Carrington class, an X event that ruins a few too many transformers and drags the grid down, or it's a liquid fuels emergency by a final failure of Middle East diplomacy. Listen, whether these risks are utterly remote and not worth talking about and concerning ourselves with, or all but certain to happen eventually, the simple fact remains that society today operates with arguably, I'm going to say, the least amount of self-sufficiency and resilience of perhaps any generation ever. And that this is something you've written extensively about to say, hey, listen, if this is true, there are things that we individually can and maybe should do in order to increase our own personal resilience. Is that fair?
That's in a nutshell. That's really it, is that we are extremely vulnerable, extremely fragile, and because we haven't had a war on American soil, really since the Civil War, we're just, you know, and things have been so nice and stable for the last, pretty much since the 50s. So most of the people growing up today have this kind of, you know, Ozzie and Harriet view of the world, that it's, you know, we're America, we've got, God has this magic shield around us, and everything's going to be okay. And history proves that just ain't so.
Well, yeah, all things change. We're in the middle, actually, of one of the greatest periods of change ever. I think that, you know, this is an exciting time to be alive. It's also a risky time. And I think for many who are listening to this right now, myself included, the risk that some form of major disruption, like the ones we just cataloged, the risk that that will occur sooner than later, it's just unacceptably high. And being
right,
prudent adults, we want to mitigate those risks by reclaiming responsibility for certain mission-critical goods and services. What we can control, maybe we should. Food, energy, water, medicine, inner resilience, these all might be at the top of our list. So I want to dive right in. Basic preparation. It probably makes sense to start right at the very beginning and talk about some things that maybe everybody should do. And here, I'm agnostic as to whether people on this list should be things people you would consider people should do, regardless of whether they live on the coast, inland, earthquake-prone area or not, urban, rural. Let's start right at the top. Is it appropriate here to start with a rule of threes?
Yeah, a rule of threes is good, sure.
Okay.
Rule of threes gives you an indication of, in a crisis time, where your energies, you know, really should lie. And the rule of threes basically says if you've got 3 seconds without blood flow, meaning, you know, you heart attack or critical injury, then without blood flow to the brain in 3 seconds, then you pass out. If you have 3 minutes without oxygen flow, then, you know, either you're not breathing or you don't have access to oxygen, then you're out. If you have 3 hours without proper shelter or clothing in extreme weather, whether it's extreme heat, and, you know, these are rough numbers. I mean, it varies in the situation. Extreme heat or extreme cold, you get hypothermic, hyperthermic, and you start to die or lose your ability to think and function. If you have 3 days without water, and you have to be physically active and it's fairly hot outside, then people start to die. So, you know, water is extremely critical. Most people in America could live at least 3 weeks, and many of us far longer than that, without food. Now, you may not be happy, you may not feel good, you might not have a lot of energy, but you could do it. So, on the scale of things, that kind of gives you an immediate priority list of you know, what things you must address and deal with that are life, obviously the obvious life-threatening things have to be dealt with first, but then water, you know, next up the list, shelter first, water, you know, life-threatening things immediate. It gives you an idea of priorities. And so every family really should have a grab-and-go kit, something, you know, it's the easiest, smallest, cheapest preparation you can do, is give yourself a, call it the go bag, a 72-hour kit, grab-and-go kit. But it's something to provide for you and your family for the basics of shelter, food, water, and medicine, emergency medical supplies, for the critical first, say, 3 days in a potential emergency before anybody else can come to help. Now, obviously, in a collapse situation, the grab-and-go kit is a good start, but it's not going to get you through a collapse. But it's certainly something that everybody can do. And, you know, I mean, I'll admit, I'm really prepared for the short term, and I'm working towards the long term. But if the world collapsed tomorrow, I have a lot of great skills and knowledge and things I could team up with other people. But could I do it on my own tomorrow? You know, probably not. If the world collapsed, could I handle a few months? Sure, no problem.
All right, so everybody should have a grab-and-go kit. Do you have anything on your list that you maybe think is probably not in what we would call a typical 72-hour kit?
Yeah, I have a few items. So, you know, I mean, obviously, there's the obvious stuff, but here's something that a lot of people never think about. And you know, from our prior conversation, I understand you're a rock climber and I'm a rock climber, and so inch-and-a-half cloth adhesive first aid tape is one of my key items in my grab-and-go kit. People say, well, why is that so important? And well, think about it. What do you see in a disaster? You see people walking down the roads. If it wasn't a real disaster, they're driving their cars, you know, unless they're broke and don't have money for cars. And so they're walking down the roads. Now, most of us, if all of a sudden you got to carry a bunch of stuff on your back and you're walking down the road and, you know, cars aren't working and whatever, whether it's an earthquake, tsunami, oil crisis, whatever, what's going to happen? Most people are going to blister up. And then all of a sudden, once those blisters on their feet pop, they're not going to go anywhere fast. So that you take that roll of inch-and-a-half cloth tape out, and you take a little bit of the sticky tape off, and you pull your shoes and socks off, and you scrub all your hot spots with the sticky tape to get rid of the oils and scum on your skin. And being a climber, I'm sure you've done this 100 times. And then you take some fresh tape out and you tape up those heels or toes or wherever it is. And certainly you can use the tape to bind wounds. You can tape up sprained ankles or a broken wrist. You know, you can do all kinds of things, repair it, rip on your tent. So that's a huge item. And in a pinch, duct tape will work, but you know, I'd rather have first aid adhesive tape on my skin than duct tape. But, you know, in a pinch, duct tape works well on everything. And so that's one item. Another item that most people don't have in their grab-and-go kit is a colloidal silver generator. And people say, well, what's that? And see, 2,000 years ago, Alexander the Great did not know a thing about germ theory. But he knew that if he stored water for his troops in wooden barrels, that the troops got sick. And a soldier that's vomiting and has diarrhea on the battlefield, it's not much good for anything. But he also knew that if he stored water in silver urns, then his men stayed healthy. So it turns out that tiny charged particles of silver have this almost magical property where they're toxic to all known pathogenic bacteria, but they're non-toxic to human beings. And they bind to proteins in the bacteria that prevents them from metabolizing oxygen. Now, it also is, this sounds too good to be true, but it turns out that the bacteria that are probiotic, that live in your gut naturally, well, the same extra-thick cellular wall that protects them from full-strength stomach acids also protects them from the colloidal silvers. So it kills the bad bacteria, not the good bacteria. Again, sounds too good to be true, but it is. So a colloidal silver generator is something that either uses electricity, typically in the form of 9-volt batteries, and it puts it across two pure silver wires, and it makes a tiny particle called a colloid of silver. It looks a little like smoke coming off the wires into the water solution. And this is sort of your pharmacy, portable pharmacy that you can, you know, help 100 people heal if you had to, if there's some nasty bug going along. And you can purify water, but it doesn't purify instantly. Like if you generate silver in water, then, you know, it might kill every bug in the water over a few hours, not like in 5 minutes to make it perfect for drinking.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly in a disaster situation, you know, you have to assume that your access to medicines and medical personnel is going to be minimal because they're going to be vastly overloaded and understaffed. And so, you know, having that on hand. Now, another item that's really good to have on hand is a headlamp. And that's where you have like a flashlight on an elastic band. And the modern headlamps are just so incredible. They run off of like three AAA batteries. They're super light. They're waterproof. They're LED powered. You know, you can drop them on the ground and they're not going to stop. In the old days, you had a massive battery pack. And if you happen to drop your headlamp or bang it into something when it was on, then the filament in the bulb would tend to break. So they're just like wonderful things, and they leave your hands free. So you can work on your car, put chains on, split wood, you know, run through the forest, you know, while you're holding something, whatever you got to do. The light flashes where your head points and your hands are free. You can even swim across the river with your headlamp on and see where you're going. So, you know, they're a wonderful item. And beyond that, basically, another no-brainer item, but it's in most kits, is you really need an excellent water filter. And I actually like to have two or three. Water's so critical, I like to have two or three things for purifying water in my grab-and-go kit. So I have multiple backups, especially if things stretch out a long time. And so I have like a backcountry water filter, a Katadyn or MSR filter, and that's something with a ceramic cartridge that's field serviceable and a carbon core to suck up nasty bad tastes and odors and chemicals. And it's field serviceable, meaning that if it plugs, you can take it apart and kind of scrub it with a green pot scrubby and put it back together and you're back in business and running. Whereas if it's not field serviceable and you got to buy a new cartridge, well, you better have a good stock of spare cartridges on hand, because once you pump it out of some scummy ditch water, you might plug it the first time and then you're SOL if that's your only thing for purifying water. And you say, well, why purify water? Well, you need minimum of 2 quarts a day, but figure on a gallon a day per person. I mean, 2 quarts a day is really not adequate if it's hot and you got to do a lot of work. And about a gallon a person per day is really pretty minimal. And so if you had a family of four for 3 days, that's 100 pounds of water you're going to go through in 3 days. Try carrying that on your back plus all the rest of your stuff.
100 pounds or 100 gallons?
It's 100 pounds because It's 8 pounds per gallon.
Oh, right. Great, yep.
So if you got a family of four, you know, that's 4 gallons a day times 3 is 12 gallons times 8 is like basically it's a little over 8 pounds a gallon, so it comes up to 100 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot to carry when there's other stuff you'd rather be carrying, like your gear and your clothing, et cetera. And let's face it, if when things fall apart in a city, you're going to be drinking out of the nearest duck pond and or river or ditch. And I, for one, would not want to drink out of that scummy duck pond or ditch, especially with a million people going to the bathroom all over the place, without first purifying it. And it's so critical, so I like to have multiple things on hand. So I have a Steripen also. And you know, have you seen the movie Men in Black?
Yes.
Yeah, so many people have. So, you know, the guy pulls his little thing out of his pocket, the flashy thing, and says, everybody take a look over here, and gives it a click, and, you know, flashes, and your memory's gone. Well, you pull your Steripen out of your pocket, and you give it a click, and you turn it upside down and put it in your water bottle, and the blue light flashes. Only it's more like 15 seconds or so it goes on. You kind of stir the bottle while the blue light's flashing, and poof, all the bugs are dead. And so the good news is you get about 4,000 clicks per batteries set in the Steripen. The bad news is if it's scummy, dirty water, all bets are off, because it's got to be clear water. So Steripen is like the fastest, simplest, quickest way to purify water when it's clear and you know, relatively clean. You want to kill the bugs, but if it's dirty, scummy water, you really got to filter it or treat it with chemicals.
So let's imagine then we've got here in our go kit, there's this 1.5-inch cloth tape. By the way, if people are looking for this, it's wonderful stuff. I actually have a roll of it with me at all times in my climbing gear. You can find it most easily. It's known also as athletic tape, but the cloth is the critical part. And by the way, nylon doesn't count in this story. They have other sort of plastic backing sometimes on this, but we're talking good old-fashioned cloth, like think cotton with adhesive on it. That's the stuff.
That's the best.
Yeah, it's great. Oh, it just doesn't come off unless you want it to, and then you still have to pull. And then you mentioned a colloidal silver generator. That's excellent. A headlamp and H2O filters, plural. That all sounds excellent. Now, in my own world, I think because I live in a rural area, there's a 99.9% chance I'm not ever going to bug out. I'm going to sort of shelter in place through almost anything I can imagine, short of the nuke plant just north of
maybe
me letting go.
Maybe. You know, in a real bad situation, the cities become death traps. And like, for instance, in medieval times when the plague, Black Death, went through Europe, If you stay in the city, you're pretty much guaranteed to die. And similarly, in the United States, in the event of a long-term grid failure, the nuclear power plants will start running out of fuel. They're mandated to have a week's worth of backup fuel on hand, and some plant operators have told me they personally carry a month. You know, and typically, it's like not a problem, because when's the grid down for longer than a week or a month? And so if you've got a widespread grid failure from an electromagnetic pulse or a solar storm or some terrorist event, could be just, you know, 200 guys with machine guns going around wiping out transformers. I mean, it's as simple as that. It doesn't take a real high-tech thing. It just takes coordination. Then all of a sudden, you've got a period, long period of time where, you know, these transformers are 300 tons each. They're tens of millions of dollars each, and they're custom designed for each installation, and there's a three-year waiting list right now to get a single one. So if one or two or three go down, well, the grid can compensate, and they can work around that, and they can have one or two spares around. But if 20 or 30 go down, or 300 to 400 in America, like a solar storm, like a 1921 or Carrington event would do, or and a couple thousand worldwide, well, that's like 10 years' supply of, if the world was working great and going maximum capacity, it'd take 10 years to make all those transformers. So you're talking a situation where, you know, getting out of the city is your only hope. And it's not something where you have to be out today or tomorrow, but it's something where you have to get out, because the cities, without a grid to support them, the cities are the last place in the world you want to be.
So now, 70%
hopefully we won't see that situation, but, you know, there's a significant likelihood of it. Like, there's a scientific study that says we have a 12% chance, that's a 1 in 8 chance, that within the next decade we'll have a Carrington event-sized solar storm, and that's a game-over kind of situation, unless we get off of our you-know-whats and spend $1 billion and put the protective gear into the grid, which so far nobody has ponied up and said, yes, I'm going to do it. I mean, the government's saying we're going to force the utilities to do it, and the utilities are paying their lobbyists and fixing the numbers on the reports and saying, ah, it's really not a big issue. Don't worry about it. Everything's okay. We got it under control, because they don't want to spend $1 billion. But basically, if no one spends that $1 billion, then it's a guaranteed solar event is going to happen. It's just a matter of the roll of the die. And if we spend the money ahead of time, then it'll be bad, but it'll be manageable. If we don't spend the money, it'll be like game over for society.
All right. And you know, 70% of the people listening to this by odds are in cities. So if you lived in a city right now, I take it you don't, but if you did, what would be right at the top of your personal list? Let's just imagine for the next 2 years, for a variety of reasons, you have to live in a city. What would your approach be there?
Well, the approach in the city is, you must have a good go bag. You must have some backcountry gear so that if you had to put things on your back, that you could do it. You know, I'm not a real gun nut, but given that America is so heavily armed, it would be a good idea to get some training and pick up some minimal self-protective kind of supplies. I mean, I hope it never comes to that, because it's not like I'm a Rambo kind of guy and I really want to go out and blow someone away or protect someone. And I certainly, you know, that's not my gig. I would also have a backup plan for, you know, if you have people you can network in the country, a place to go, a plan of, if I had to leave the city. See, 37% of all Americans live within 50 miles of a nuclear power plant. So that's, think of that, 50 miles from Fukushima, 37, more than 1 in 3 Americans. They build these nuke plants near major metro areas because it costs a lot of money to pay for transmission losses to move the power a long distance. So they build the plants relatively near, you know, to the places where they're going to use the power, far enough away that it don't make people nervous, but close enough so they don't lose a lot in transmission. So you need to know where your nuclear power plants are, and you need to have a game plan for how, if things were down for a long time, how you could manage to get out. Now, obviously, if you're able to figure things out and use gasoline and drive a car to get out of town in the initial period before everyone else has figured it out, that's best. But if you need a backup plan in the event that that doesn't happen, or, you know, somebody takes your car away from you or whatever. I mean, there's no way to protect yourself for absolutely everything, but think resilience, think about short-term, yeah, sheltering in place is great. If it's a short-term emergency, it's not an earthquake and everything hasn't fallen apart, sheltering in place is fine. If it's a longer-term emergency or everything has really fallen apart, then, and you're in a city, then you have to know that there's no way that city of millions of people is going to feed itself and take care of itself, and you're going to have to leave. So
now,
you have to have a backup plan.
In that backup plan, I know that one of the key things that happens even, say, during a hurricane or happened on 9/11 is that communications become extraordinarily difficult. Under that circumstance, I know that it's even FEMA says you should have a family emergency plan, meaning your family should know what to do. Quite often during the day, we're separate from each other. And if something
right.
happened and developed rather suddenly and communications are impossible, all the cell towers are jammed or otherwise unavailable to us in that moment, talk to us, what is a family emergency plan and how would somebody go about developing one?
Well, well, I'll talk about some key points, just like the grab-and-go kit. But like, if you want details and more than I can say on the air, then the emergency plan and the grab-and-go kit and purifying water and protecting yourself from the next superbug, detailed articles with all that information is totally free on my website at whentechfails.com, whentechfails.com. So when you think about a plan, think about, you know, some basic things for your plan is figuring out a local meeting place. If you're separated and the communications are down and you can't get to your home, then everyone meets at, say, you know, the local high school yard or a Red Cross shelter or, you know, something. Just some place where if for some reason, like I live in wildfire and earthquake country, and so easily things could get cut off, and so the question is, where would you meet? Also think of an out-of-town contact. Like I know, during the Loma Prieta quake, I had a friend up here who was saying his wife was visiting down in the Santa Cruz Mountains, and he was pretty frantic after the quake because the information was so minimal, and he could not reach his wife by cell phone or landline, and so he had no idea if she was in an area that was, you know, if she was hurt or killed, and because there were people hurt and killed in Santa Cruz and in the Bay Area. And it turned out she was able to get a phone call out after a while. So often think about an out-of-town contact like Mary Sue in St. Louis or whatever, where if you're separated and you do have a chance to get some communications, then call and leave a message with Mary Sue, and then everyone can check in there. Think if everyone in your family knows how to turn off the gas, you know, if you have natural gas and the electricity and the water to your house, that's important. More of the electricity and gas than water. Because in, say, an earthquake situation, wildfire situation, being able to turn off the gas to your house could make the difference between it turning into a bomb and a torch versus, you know, coming out okay. Same thing, especially in earthquakes, because gas, water heaters and things tend to fall over and break lines, and then gas lines, you know, hit a pilot light or something and light on fire, and everything goes up in flames. So those things are important. So those are some basic thoughts for a family emergency plan, and there's certainly more details available on my website in that article.
That's excellent advice, and that website again, whentechfails, with an S, .com.
Right. Oh, and also,
yeah.
Both my books, When Disaster Strikes, which is more of a regular-sized book that's comprehensive survival and prepping guide in handbook in one, and When Technology Fails, which is a big, massive phone book-sized book that covers prepping and survival, but it also covers sustainable living. It covers, you know, primitive technologies like if everything fell apart, could we replicate, say, some 18th century technologies rather than falling back to caveman days? And so if you're really worried about long-term collapse, then you want to have the big book, When Tech Fails. If you want a perfect book for your go bag that gives you survival stuff and prepping information, then the newer book, When Disaster Strikes, is perfect for that.
Excellent. So I think of the three big buckets of preparedness. There's stuff you have, there's stuff you know, and then there are your skills, things you can do, but also including your mindset.
Correct.
Across those three, which do you feel is most important if you could choose, and where would you suggest most people, on average, need to start on this?
Well, the most important is the skill set, including the mindset, because you take that with you wherever you go.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd say in that direction, I'm like very, very well prepared. I'd still like to know more, you know, more practical experience foraging, things like that, being able to forage for food and identify plants. But that's so important because, you know, if things really fall apart and you have to pick up and move, which with climate change and world changes is a distinct possibility, not a pleasant thing to ponder, but a distinct, a significant possibility, probability, some would say. So that's most important. And then your stuff, you know, and so a lot of people, you know, some people have plenty of money. And so by all means, you know, gather stuff, gather supplies, put things, store food, have some, you know, beans, Band-Aids, and bullets, meaning the three Bs, meaning beans, meaning your food and supplies, Band-Aids, meaning medical skills and medical knowledge, medical supplies, and bullets, meaning the ability to protect yourself. Again, that's not really my bag, but it's a necessary evil. So get the stuff, and even if you're not really great at using some of it, you can trade, you can barter, you can share, you can team up with people. I mean, the lone wolf in a collapse situation will probably not do very well unless he's, you know, super MacGyver, because someone who's meaner and tougher and better organized will come along and take all his cool stuff away from him. It's really in groups that people will do better. You know, think medieval times, castles, villages, groups. There was safety in numbers, plus people have skills and talents, you know. It really takes a village to pull through. It's not something that can be done very well with just a lone wolf, at least in the long run. In the short run, the lone wolf may well be fine, but in the long run, probably not so. So, you know, think about your strengths. I mean, naturally, if you can develop all three areas, great. But if not, if you're stronger in one, if you don't have money, focus on your skill set. You know, if you're likable, get along well, you have great skills and talents, then you'll probably manage pretty well. If maybe you're older and you're not very strong and you can't do much, but if you have good financial reserves, then you can stock up on things that you'll be able to team up with, and a whole bunch of people will be thankful and grateful for you if and when that day comes when that stuff is needed. And the mindset is so important. My father-in-law was a Dutch resistance fighter. He had a third grade education. He was born in World War I, and he was one of 14 children, and he never knew his parents. They died in the latter parts of the war, and he was raised by an older sister. And after the third grade, he was told, "Joseph, you eat too much, you know, you got to go out and get a job because we're poor and we don't have enough money to feed ourselves, much less you." So imagine after the third grade being forced to go out and work full-time and whatever kind of labor, doing whatever you could to survive. And, you know, that's kind of unfathomable for most of us here in America. So he was a survivor. He got captured by the Nazis, sentenced to death, tortured, put in front of a firing squad, shot with blanks three times trying to break his spirit. And on the day of his execution, underground soldiers came to his jail cell. They walked in dressed as Nazis. They were border town people, spoke perfect German. Said, "Joseph, Justin, we're going to take him and execute him." They looked up and said, "Oh, yeah, he's to be executed today. Take him away." It was his real day of execution. I mean, he'd been sentenced to death in a public trial. And they got to the yard, and he thought this was it, and he was really going to get shot. And they helped him over the fence. He jumped down, broke both ankles, got pulled into a car, and went away. The point of the matter is, here's a guy with a third-grade education. Joyful attitude. He was not sour. He was not dour. He was always making jokes, always laughing, positive attitude. He survived the Indonesian Revolution when 9 out of 10 of his partners and compatriots died. He survived, World War II and the resistance and not tortured and sentenced to death. He had an incredible attitude. He had a joyful, positive, surviving attitude. But he also wasn't blinded by positiveness. You know, he had like a radar out. And I do teach some exercise in my book for developing your inner compass to help guide you, because I do believe that there's an inner source of wisdom and knowledge that can guide us to make split-second life-and-death decisions and do the right thing. And it's built into each and every one of us. It's like this most amazing survival mechanism that Mother Nature built into every one of us. And so learning to develop that and use that, I think, is going to be important in the uncertain times to come.
So this this inner compass is something that we're all born with?
Yeah, I believe that it's in our DNA, that those beings that didn't have it, they got eaten by the saber-toothed tigers, or they got popped in the pot by the cannibals and died in the battlefield, whatever. So I think Mother Nature built it into each and every one of us. Some call it your gut feel, your intuition, your spirit guides. You know, it's something which just knows what to do. And there's a wonderful book called The Gift of Fear by Gavin DeBecker, and he talks about how that feeling, that inner compass, just guides people. And so many countless survivors will say, oh, God, we got into this trouble because I ignored it, but then, you know, it kicked in and it saved me by getting me to go do the right actions at the right moment in time to do the right thing. And so I teach this pit of the stomach exercise in both my books to help people get in touch with that. Because let's face it, in a crisis situation, you usually don't have very good information. It's like if it was... You don't have CNN, you don't have telephones and cell phones and someone telling you what to do. So it's like your rational mind's only as good as the information it has to draw upon, and that's always imperfect at best. So when you're in a situation where you don't really know what to do, I mean, you know you can't trust your mind when it is changing its mind, whatever it is, every few seconds. It says, oh, I think I should do this. And then a few minutes later, oh, no, I should do that. Oh, no, maybe I should go this way. Maybe I should go that way. Then it's like, okay, wait a minute, slow down. It's like you can't trust this great rational mind that's changing its mind every few seconds and flip-flopping all over the place. So at that moment in time, you're going to have to get in touch with something else to make a decision because you just simply don't have the information to make a good decision.
You know, this is a core tenet of mine. I wrote a piece, must be in 2006 now. I called it Trust Yourself. And I was basically wanting to give people permission to tune out what they're hearing, even, you know, from our so-called information sources, and just trust yourself in terms of knowing, you know, what's right or what's coming next. And I think a lot of people who are listening to this right now already have a pit in their stomach. We all collectively know that something in our model is broken. Some of us have intellectual understanding of that framework. Others of us have gotten to it intuitively. Either way, I'm agnostic. However you've come by the information that things have changed and it's time to take action to protect you, your loved ones, and whatever is required to move you past whatever inaction might be holding you in place. That's what I care about most in this story right now. And the thing that's been fascinating to me is I've discovered in my own life, and I've been able to use this with other people as well, is that when I have anxiety, when I have fear around something, I look into the future and I go, oh, I just don't like what I see. I find that the amount of anxiety I have is a measure of the gap between what I know and what I'm doing about it. And anything I can do to close that gap up, and you have a lot of very, very specific things that people can do. I haven't read When Disaster Strikes, but I know that When Technology Fails is absolutely just chock full of very specific things people can do. And, you know, we're at heart, I think, all wannabe, like your father-in-law, that hopeful person, and that hopefulness combined with a certain amount of rationality will see us through. And I have a certain level of hopefulness through all of this because I know that if we get the story right collectively and individually, that we can have a much better future than the one we seem to be heading towards. And so in your mind, I mean, you still obviously are a very hopeful, very cheerful person. Do you think in a sustainable world, a durable earth, is this just a pie in the sky fantasy? Do we have to go through some really hard times or can we get to a more hopeful place if we choose wisely?
Well, I think, yes.
Yes, good answer.
yes to all. I call myself the optimistic doomer. Uh-huh. And I do believe a sustainable future is doable. I also know that the cards are stacked against us right now because the 1% that got where they are, whether it's a corporation or an individual, the gun on the top of the pyramid, they got there through the old way and the old system that is also soiling the nest and ruining the planet. So they have a huge amount at stake at keeping the system going, but keeping the system going is like 100% guarantee for catastrophic failure. So most people, when I ask the same question, I speak to lots of groups of people at different events, And I've asked this question to thousands of people in the last few years. And first I'll ask, like, how many of you think that everything's okay, that we can keep going what we're doing and it's going to be okay? And up until recently, I didn't have a single hand out of those thousands of people raise their hand. One guy raised his hand, but I think he was being facetious.
Uh-huh.
Then I ask, how many people think that no matter what we do, we pass the tipping point? And it used to be that one out of three people would say, yeah, they're like, no, I think we passed it, and the giant train wreck's going to happen no matter what we do. And then it used to be that two out of three people would be in the optimistic doomer category that I count myself in, where they feel that we're going to have to get shaked around and knocked around pretty badly and then restructure the world and make major changes. Like, just driving a hybrid car ain't going to be enough. You know, it's got to be major changes in the way the world works to pull through. But I think it's doable, but it's going to take major change. And right now, we're not shaken up badly enough to make that major change. Nowadays, it turns out that I'm seeing two out of three people feeling we passed the tipping point and the train wreck's going to happen no matter what, and only one out of three in the optimistic doomer category. And essentially nobody, you know, that one guy so far who felt everything was okay. So I think as a race intuitively that we're getting on a massive scale that it is unsustainable. It is headed for the wall. And whether it's a pandemic or an EMP and nuclear meltdowns, or whether it's the, you know, cascading fall through various natural disasters and ecological disasters that takes us down, we're headed for that wall one way or the other.
So, yeah, I hold the same view, which is that there is a inertia to the system, and that the system wants to perpetuate itself, and that the incentives for maintaining status quo are extraordinarily strong. And given that point of view, I am optimistic, I am hopeful, and I'm also planning as if there is a major shakeup coming, because the path we are on, whether we just look at it economically, from an energy standpoint, in the environment, they're all unsustainable trends at this point. And the definition of unsustainable is it's going to change or stop someday. So
right.
I know that the major systems are due for a shakeup. I don't know when. I don't ever try to predict when, and you and I had a pre-conversation. You don't either, because we're steeped in this enough to know that these things are inherently unpredictable in terms of their timing, but the direction is easy to catalog. You know, if you know you're on an active set of plates that haven't given up an earthquake in a long time, that doesn't mean that they've given up on earthquakes. It just means that you're going to have a bigger one when it finally comes. And my question is, it seems like a lot of what we've been talking about, there are certain inevitable changes that are coming, and that there are certainly things that we can do on an individual level to mitigate some of those risks, be those financial risks or physical. Maybe some of these are around emotional risks that these changes are really going to hit some people hard, and so being emotionally resilient is important. There might even be spiritual dimensions for people. And so out of all of these, you look into the future, you consider yourself an optimistic doomer, and the question is really, out of all of that, what is it that gets you out of bed? What are you really excited about in this story? And what are the positive changes that you see that can come out of all of this?
Well, I believe that we're going to have a kinder world when we're done with this, that's going to treat Mother Nature and the Earth and people, individuals, with much more respect. It won't be this, because the system with the goal is to get as much stuff, as much wealth, consume as much as possible, is totally unsustainable and can't keep going. So I see that when it's all done, we're going to have a much healthier, more balanced planet. The pain is how do we get from here to there? And do most of us go away, population of the planet, do we self-regulate and take the population down to a sustainable level, in a relatively painless way? Or does Mother Nature step in because we do the boom and bust and collapse situation, and most of us starve or die in various pandemics? And how do we end this story? And my optimism is in doing my best to do what I know and feel is the right path, in for myself and for the planet, and how can I serve? And so in writing When Technology Fails, that was my goal. I had I mean, people say, well, what's an MIT engineer doing writing a book like When Technology Fails?
Yep.
Mean, you know, it doesn't make sense. And it's like, well, back in 1999, or 1997, I'd had at that point in time, a 20-year practice of morning meditation and prayer that started after a significant event from a 108-year-old yogi back in 1977. Anyway, I made a generic request for guidance and inspiration, and I got a bomb dropped in my lap that morning. I received what must be described as a vision, basically a holographic, pictorial, moving storyboard outline, outlining this massive book project to help people live more sustainably and to also help them cope with the failure of central services in our highly complex society for significant periods of time. And my first thought was, no effing way. I mean, I don't know all this stuff. I'm an engineer. I'm not a writer. And I don't know it all. I can't do this. And yeah, the little voice, you know, Jesus calls it the still small voice in my head, said, well, nobody knows it all. And it assured me I had the skills and talents that should I take this project on, that I would actually be able to complete it. And I didn't just jump right up and say, God talked to me today, and I'm going to save the world and write this really cool book. It took me about a year to decide that it was a good idea and that it was actually doable. And, you know, I ran it by some well-known people, and they thought it was a great idea. And then another year to find a publisher and write sample chapters and get a contract and get the book sold. And then another year to rack up the credit cards and work 70 hours a week and put my engineering business mostly on hold and make it happen. And so it was more like I got dragged into this kicking and screaming, or I accepted my cosmic homework assignment. And sometimes it hasn't been much fun. I mean, I racked up huge debt, and my first publisher was bankrupt and never paid me. So it was like, for what I spent on writing my book, I could have bought 5 acres and built myself a great Earthship home, and instead I got this really cool book that's helped a lot of people around the world, but I'm in a similar financial situation to many others. So I'm doing the best I can for the long-term preparations within the financial means I have at my disposal.
Great story about how that all came about. And at the beginning of this, the part I was drawn to as well is this idea that that the preparing itself is not the end. It's something that we see some difficult time coming. We see some difficult times coming. And for myself, that's a period I'm going to get through. The important question I'm asking myself is, where do I want to be when I come out the other side? You know, what core values do I want to have? What am I not willing to do, or what am I willing to do in order to get there? Because, you know, all of history says that sometimes you live in very interesting times and sometimes they're a little bit quieter. And we're coming up on an extraordinarily interesting period of history. And so it's not sufficient to simply ask, how am I going to enter that period, which is important. It's also, I think, just as important to ask ourselves, and how am I going to exit that period? What does this look like on the back end? Those are both, I think, critical dimensions of this.
Yeah, and it's what gift can I bring to the world?
Mm-hmm.
How can I serve? You know, every morning I ask that question, whether it's in a few minutes of silent prayer and meditation, or if I'm rushed, I just ask that question during, you know, maybe on my long distance run at the end of the day. I say, you know, how can I serve? You know, guide me. What should I be doing at this moment in time? And you could say it's just your intuition, your subconscious. You could say it's the Holy Spirit, your spirit guides. It's whatever. I don't care if you're Buddhist or Christian or Muslim, you know, or Jewish. It just doesn't matter to me. I believe that internal compass and inner guidance system is available to each and every human being, totally regardless of what spiritual or belief, you know, what religion they're a part of or what belief system they operate under.
Well, fantastic. We've been talking today with Matt Stein, and author of When Technology Fails, also When Disaster Strikes. Clearly, we could talk forever. We've just barely scratched the surface. Big topics. So these are big books, lots in them. And I would invite you to also check out whentechfails.com, where you can find more of Matt's writing and potentially some of his more current thoughts and ideas right there, as well as some tools, including the Family Planning Guide, if I have that right. Emergency plan guide. Yep. And so thank you so much for your time today, and I hope maybe we can go deeper at some point in the future.
You're welcome. Yeah, I'd love to be on any time. And I like to close with my motto, and my motto is, I urge everyone to do your best to change the world and do your best to be ready for the changes in the world. And thank you so much for having me on your show today.
Great closing words. You're welcome, and thank you.